for recovering alcoholics.
Is this thing on this morning?
Yeah.
You hear back in the back? Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 5,673 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. Man, it's good to see this big a bunch turn out on Saturday morning for the big book study. Normally, at the one we run where just Joe and I, we always end up at about this same point on Sunday mornings. This time it's Saturday morning, and we'll be talking about sex on Saturday. Normally, we talk about it on Sundays. We'll have about as much fun with it this morning, I hope. We've been discussing the book starting way back on last Thursday. And we talked about the fact that the big book was written with three basic ideas in mind. It would have three goals, or would show us three things. The first being, what is the problem? And the second being, what is the solution? And the third being, how do you find the solution, or actually the planned program of action necessary to bring about recovery? We looked in the doctor's opinion, and we looked in Bill's story, and there we could definitely see the problem. We could see the physical allergy. We could see the obsession of the mind. We could see the hopeless condition of the mind and body resulting from the disease of alcoholism. And there probably we could find the information necessary to be able to say, well, yeah, we're powerless over alcohol, and certainly our life has become unmanageable. We looked in chapter 2, 3, and 4. In the chapter there is a solution and more about alcoholism and we agnostics. And there we could see that if we had become powerless over alcohol, then the only hope for our recovery would be to find the power not only greater than we are and greater than alcohol, but greater than human power, period. And we begin to see in those three chapters what this power could do for us. We begin to see that it could restore us to sanity, to the ability to make rational decisions when it comes to alcohol. And we could begin to see that this power wasn't necessarily a power that we needed to be afraid of, or that we needed to understand, or that was too extremely difficult to find. Through those three chapters, we could see a simple process by which we could avail ourselves of the help of this power greater than we are. And we could see where that would start with the simple idea of just believing, or being willing to believe. And step two tells us that's really all we have to do. You know, we just got to become willing to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, sane, rational thinking when it comes to alcohol. And we could see based upon belief we would need to decide and then act, and then we could get some results. And when we left off, we were into chapter 5, and we had talked about step three, the need to remove self to as much extent as we possibly could. And the book telling us that selfish and self-centeredness seems to be the root of a problem, and told us that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, because under those conditions we're almost always in collision with people, places, and things. And we stay in collision with them, and we stay restless and irritable and discontented, and the mind begins to return back to the idea of taking a drink. So apparently, if we are to live and live happily and be peaceful and have some serenity and peace of mind, we do need something else to direct our thinking. And that was the exact words that the big book uses in How It Works. We want to let God be the director of our lives. In step four, we could see where we would need to remove some certain things from the shelf of our business. And we talked about our business being the business of life. And we compared it to the commercial inventory. And it said the commercial inventory that has damaged and unsaleable goods on the shelf is probably going to go broke if they don't inventory it and do something about it. And we could see where our damaged and unsaleable goods were the thoughts in our mind. And that's what blocked us off from carrying out the decision we made in three. So we started an inventory process to see what needed to be removed. And we find there's three common manifestations of self. The three things that seemed to block us off faster than anything else, and we looked at the first one, which was the number one offender, and that was resentments. We made a list of resentments, We made a list of the people that we resented, we were mad at. We put down the cause of the resentment. We looked at the part of self which was affected, the resentment actually coming from self. We begin to see that it's not so much the people that's the problem as our reaction to the people, places, and things and what they're doing. And we could see where self was the cause of the reaction. We saw how to get rid of these resentments. We saw what they would do to us. They block us off from the sunlight of the Spirit and cause us to drink. We begin to look at them from a different angle and begin to realize we had to get them removed. We saw in the book how to remove resentments. Well, the book tells us and gives us examples of how we can pray for the one we resent, and gradually the resentments begin to disappear. And the last thing it asked us to do in resentments was to review our inventory again and look at where we had been at fault and look at our own pride, our own selfishness, our own dishonesty, our own being frightened, and our own inconsideration of other people. And we could see where if we were not that way, that type of personality, then probably the resentment wouldn't surface in the first place, regardless of what other people did. And for the first time, we begin to see the parts of the personality that really need to be changed. The selfishness and the dishonesty and the being frightened and the inconsideration of others. And if we can get rid of those, then we do not need to develop resentments in the future. And if we keep resentments out of our head, then we stand a chance of peace of mind, a mind open up to the extent that God can begin to enter and give directions in our life. Joe?
My name is Joe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. Through God's grace, because the program works in my life, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink the day since March 1962. I always have to laugh. I can't count as high as Charlie, so I just do mine that way.
20 and a half, that's all he can do.
This morning, this brings us to fear. And I was talking to a few people yesterday and really excited about inventory. And, you know, I think it's so great when we can go back to the big book and get back to the great simplicity of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and taking our inventory. As we said, you know, we're going to go through them individually, and now it's going to bring us to the next sheet, review of our fears. Notice the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil cordoning thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And you know, I think that as we sit here in the room and as people, and listen to the big book and think that probably all the things in our lives that have been stolen out of our lives as a result of fear. You know, fear has robbed us of so many things. Lose the board. Okay. We review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentments in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. It wasn't because self-reliance failed us. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. And we can see here the three things that we do. Number one, we list, what do we fear? I think as we were talking today, as we look at these instincts, and what we're trying to do is to see what fear has done as we apply to these instincts. You know, we know that these instincts, as we said, that make up self are are God-given, and they are not bad. And human life is so simple. And we said if we didn't have self-esteem and companionship and these persons, we didn't have security, or if we didn't have sex, we wouldn't be complete human beings. And what we like to do is really, if you would look at your basic instincts and then see that they are necessary, and then see what would happen if you applied God's will towards your instincts, you would have one life. Now take those same instincts and apply self-will to them. You see something, you see self-will run right. So this is the basis of the whole problem. And when we can look at these things, and we can know that we're supposed to have material security. But when we apply self-will to material security, we have fears. And so we want to find the manifestations of these things and see exactly where they are coming from. Now he says, some of us had great confidence, but it didn't fully solve the real problem of any other. When he made us cocky, it was worse. I've got it ready. Okay, now so we're going to go to the first column, and we're going to start off with I am fearful of. And just fill that column out from top to bottom. Everything is very easy to exalt your mind of everything that you are fearful of. Everything.
We're not necessarily just talking about physical fear.
No.
You know, we alcoholics, most people, and we alcoholics especially, seem to have a whole lot of fear running around in our head. You know, kind of like the guy that used to be in Little Abner. He ran around all the time, and he had a dark cloud hanging over his head, and raindrops falling out. And everywhere he went, he created absolute catastrophe. His name was Joe Blitzfib or something like that. And I know all my life I didn't know what was going to happen. But I knew when it did, it damn sure wasn't going to be any good. And all my life I've had thousands of fears inside me, but I never did want the world to see them. Because I thought a man that's strong and stands on his own 2 feet, he don't run around talking about what he's afraid of. But if I carefully examine my fears, I find that I am riddled with fear. In many, many cases, in most cases, I even find that the same is with resentments. I've usually set the ball rolling in some way or other and made a decision based on self, which later placed me in a position to become fearful. For instance, one of my fears back some years ago was the Internal Revenue Service. And what is the cause of that fear? Well, the cause of that fear is, by God, I cheated on my income tax. One of my fears, even a long time after getting sober, was that my wife was going to divorce me. You see, she divorced me 3 times the last year I drank. And I just knew that sooner or later she's going to do that again, even though I was staying sober. And the cause of the fear was the things that I was doing to cause her to want to divorce me. If I hadn't been out doing a lot of things that I was doing when I was drinking, probably the divorce suits would never have appeared in the first place. And as I begin to look at my fears and list them, and then I list the cause, again I realize that most of my fears are not based upon other people and what they're doing, but most of my fears are based upon things that I have done in the past, or a fear that I'm going to lose something that I've already got, or a fear that I'm not going to get something that I think that I need so badly. And I list my fears and I list my causes, and then I go to the part of self that is affected. And invariably, in order for me to be afraid, one of the 3 basic instincts of life has to have been threatened in some way. It's a fear based upon what other people think of me, or upon what I think of myself. It's a fear that it will destroy a human relationship. It's a fear regarding my emotional or material security. Or it's a fear regarding my sex life, either my hidden sex life or my acceptable sex life, if I'm lucky enough to have both from time to time. Almost invariably, I can trace it right down and find out what part of self is creating the fear. Just the same as I could trace it down and see what part of self created the resentments. Then I can look at the fourth column. And I can see in that fourth column where if I wasn't so selfish, I wouldn't be so afraid. I can see where if I wasn't so dishonest, I would not have put myself in a position where I have to be afraid. I can see where if I wasn't so inconsiderate of my wife and other people, that I wouldn't keep doing things that would put me in a position of being afraid that they were going to retaliate. I can see where I have become a very frightened individual. And again, I look at the parts of the personality that continually creates the fears, and lo and behold, they are the same things that continually created the resentments. You know, the selfishness, the self-seeking, the frightened, the inconsideration, the dishonesty. And if I don't change those parts of my personality, then I'll never be able to keep fears away from them. I look at them exactly like I did resentments. And after I've looked at them, analyzed them, see where they come from, and see what I need to get rid of to keep them from coming back in the future, my book also tells me how to get rid of fear in step four, the same as it told me how to get rid of resentments.
It's clearing up a little bit, and we move over here on this, on self. When you go down this column to find out which part of self is affected, put down your fears, or if you're doing your resentments, put them all down, put down the causes next. And then when you get over to self, go down each column like self-esteem. See if it affected, see if your self-esteem was threatened. Go from top to bottom all the way down that column. Take each of those columns separately as little columns and put your check mark. Don't go across them either. Go straight down each of those little columns and until you complete each one of them from top to bottom. That's the way you fill out the self part. And when you get through, you have a series of checks, and you'll be able to look back and see how many different things was affected once you're through completing it.
Okay, the middle of page 68, it said, perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Now, we've gone now from self-reliance to God-reliance.
That's right.
That's what we really decided to do when we took step three. We're going to quit directing ourselves and let God be the director. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role that He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage, and all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And we can take each individual fear the same as we did resentments. And most of them are going to disappear when you put them down on this sheet of paper. You know, some of them are so ridiculous that when we really look at them and see what part of self is creating them, and what character defect lets them cut? Some of them are so ridiculous, they just disappear. But the fears that stay with us, we can take them on an individual basis and ask God to remove that from us, and then ask Him to direct us what He would have us be in place of that fear. And the book tells me at once we commence to outgrow fear. So the same thing happens with fears that happens with resentments. During this process, we find fears beginning to be removed from our mind. Now just think, we've had a mind full of resentments, we've had a mind full of fear, and we've had a mind full of the wrongs and the results of the wrongs that we do to other people. We saw how to get rid of them in resentments. We saw how to now how to get rid of them in fears. And as we begin to practice this and the resentments begin to disappear and the fears begin to disappear, then the mind has a little more peace, a little more serenity, a little more happiness, and it begins to open up a little bit more, and now God's will can enter even better than it could after we dealt with resentments. Now we got one more unsaleable item on the shelf. We've got rid of two of them. Now we got one more left, one more kind of thinking we got to get out of our head. And that seems to be in the area of the harms that we do to other people. And it seems as though we hurt other people faster and easier in the area of sexual conduct than we do in any other way. And our book is going to suggest that we go back through our life and review our sexual conduct, just like we reviewed resentments and just like we reviewed fears. And it's going to suggest we look at the people we've harmed and see what really causes us to do those things. Because you see, I've got to live with some guilt associated with that. We know the difference between right and wrong. And even if they don't catch me, I've got to live with fears of what are they going to do if they did catch me. And to get peace of mind, I've got to get this stuff out of my head. And about the only way we do it is to get it on paper and look at it. Now, the book says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, you older fellas, don't get your hopes up. This is not dealing with physical sex. It's not going to it's not going to get us any better than we are right now in physical area. Pete has been hoping that something would happen, you know. This is Pete's fifth time, and he ain't no better at it now than he was before. What we're going to be dealing with primarily is emotional sex, mental, the way we look at sex, the way we think about sex, and then what sex itself causes us to do that actually harms other people. Joe?
Okay, it's easy to get off track. Here we find human opinions running to extreme absurdity. Third extreme, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a basic necessity for procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who prevail the institution of marriage, who think that most of our troubles of race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor of his flesh, the other would have us on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be an arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And here it's we talk about the basic instincts of life, and one of them is sex. And we said these are survival instincts. All of these things are survival instincts, and all of these things are we don't have anything bad in our lives. And I was glad. Everything that's causing us trouble is we just got too much of some good stuff. And it's all about, and my book talks about rearrangements and adjustments. We're going to move some things over here and move. This is recovery. This is a process of getting some things out and moving some things around, putting everything in its right place, not getting rid of anything, really. And sex is a part of human life, and when it's a God gave man this instinct, and it's for the survival of the human race. There had to be a great drive or a great instinct placed in man for him to have sex so that the human race would survive. So this is this thing called sex. Everybody talks about it, don't nobody know about it much. And I think it's great in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we can. Our book talks about it in a great way. He says, now we're talking about the instinct of sex. And we want to stay out. Everybody has sex problems. And no one, this is such a strong drive that no one is perfect with this. You know, it's great to hear that, you know, because I always felt like I was the only one that had a problem with this. And, I really remember when I first come to AA, I was like most people, I knew really nothing about sex. I thought I did, but I knew nothing about it, except in a physical sense. And when they started talking to me about they had sex problem, I had a sex problem. I said, "Y'all crazy? I know y'all crazy. I ain't got no sex problem." You know, and I didn't, you know, because I didn't know what they were talking about. And they said, "Well, we do." And I said, "Well, something wrong with y'all." Because I don't have one of them. But we know God gave man we have a unique life as far as the animals on the face of this earth. And we are special as compared to the lower class of animals. God gave us a unique sex life. He gave us a sex instinct that produces this reproduction. And the lower class of animals don't have that. Their sex is initiated by a physical change. It's a physical thing with them. There's no emotional involvement at all. And they just have sex and recreate and go on by their way. But ours had that. We had the family. Ours produces the family unit, and there's emotional ties along with this. And without this, we wouldn't have the society that we have, because sex is the basic structure of our society. Because this produces the family, and the families actually produce the larger, like the communities, and the communities produce the states and the nations, and the families of the world really can be traced right back to this basic thing. So it's not only a basic part of our recreation, it's part of the structure of our society. Now, he didn't give this to the lower class of animals, so they have sex. And, you know, suppose we were like the lower class of animals. Suppose we recreated like the lower class of animals. And this said that, you know, when a woman come in heat, we just happen to have sex. Now, that would be total chaos. We wouldn't have a society. And like I said, can you imagine what the supermarket would look like, or the grocery store, or the drugstore? It'd be total chaos. So our sex life is initiated in a very unique way. We have a special, there would be no families, there would be no structure at all. So our sex is that we have an instinct, and we all have problems with this instinct. We'd hardly be humans if we didn't. What can we do about them? Okay, we review our sex conduct over the past years. Well, and then here we see the same, you know, we see the same, the fourth column. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Now he jumps back, he's got it down kind of, he starts with the fourth column, and he comes back to the first column. Whom did we hurt? Did we unjustly arouse bitterness, suspicion, jealousy, bitterness, suspicion? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this down on paper. So we're going to just go through this same thing, and we're going to put whom did I harm? We're going to do this. We're going to go from top to bottom. And it didn't necessarily mean, he said, where did I arouse? You know, if your sex instinct sometimes, you might not have done anything, actually, in a physical sense. Maybe it wasn't something wrong sexually, but sometimes where did your sex instinct even arouse jealousy and bitterness? You might not have done anything, but your sex instinct, everybody has sex problems, because everybody somewhere, sex instinct has at least aroused some bitterness and jealousy amongst other people, whether anything was occurred or not. So we have all of us have sex problems once we really understand what sex, the instinct, not the act. The instinct causes problems with people, conflicts with people. The instinct hurts people without the act.
We know that the basic difference between we human beings and animals, period, is the ability to think and reason. Surely God did intend for the human race to have dominion over the earth. And he gave us self-will so that we could think and so that we could reason and so that we could have dominion over the other animals on the earth. He gives the same instincts to the animals, but they react to it blindly. You know, in their fight and drive to be the leader of the animal world, They're simply following a basic instinct. They do not have the power to reason and determine how to do that. In their drive to be secure in the future, we know that they have that because the little squirrel, we see him hiding the nuts in the tree so he'll have them to eat next winter, but he really doesn't know why he's doing it. He's driven strictly by instinct. We know that the birds have the ability to travel thousands and thousands of miles and return to the same place year after year after year after year simply because they are driven by instincts and they do not have the ability to think. Now, can you just imagine 40 or 50 of we alcoholics deciding to fly from here to South Africa on instinct only? Why, hell, we wouldn't get 30 miles out of town, and one of us would say we're going the wrong damn direction, you know? And we'd start fighting and arguing over where we were going. The same in sex. We know that God gives the basic instincts of sex to animals for the same purpose, so that they can procreate too. But he really doesn't give them the ability to think and reason about it. And they simply have sex based upon physical changes. And when the sex act is over, they go on about their business. But if he really intended for us to have dominion over the rest of the earth, then he intended for us to form these units that we have, such as the family units and the city units and the country units and et cetera, so we would join together and band together and have the great strengths that we have. And in giving us the ability to think and reason, this is what really began to create the problems that mankind has. So we're not talking about our ability to do sex. What we're talking about is how we think about sex, and in turn, how that thinking about sex puts us into positions which create problems for us. And this sex thing is so great and so strong, and the feeling that we get from it is so good that it seems to create an insatiable desire for more of the same. Not only the physical release and gratification which comes with sex, but the emotional release and gratification, and we want more of the same. And we keep on trying to do it in the wrong places, in many cases at the wrong times, with the wrong people, insist on having it our way, insist on doing things the way we want to do them, when we want to do them, and where we want to do them. And because of that, then we are conflicting with other people and their basic instincts also. And then they in turn retaliate. And then that causes suffering and pain and humiliation for us. And even if they don't retaliate, we've got to be filled with the fear of what are they going to do if they find out. And even if we're not doing it, we got to be filled with the fear of what are they going to think if they find out I'm thinking about doing it. I'm beginning to see now what Jimmy Carter was talking about when he got into so damn much trouble with the sex thing. So the book says what we really ought to do is review our sex conduct and see where it comes from and see what's happened to us in our life in the past because of sex. If we don't look at it, we'll never be able to avoid it in the future. And one of the greatest things that I got out of the book is this. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. That is for each individual human being to determine in their relationship with their God as they understand it. Most books I've read on this subject seems to want to tell you what's right and wrong. And the big book doesn't do that at all. It recognizes that on one hand, we got a set of voices that say there's only one way you can do sex. And that's in that straight missionary style, and you use it to reproduce children. And if you do it any other way, you're going to go to hell as sure as anything. And I've heard them all my life. On the other hand, it recognizes we got a set of voices that say, oh my God, the troubles of the whole human race can be traced to sex. We ain't got enough of it. You ought to have more of it. You ought to be able to do it with anybody you want to, anytime you want to, anywhere you want to, la, da, 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 da. Well, those are to the extremes in either way. As we travel throughout the world, we find that sexual conduct changes in different parts of the world. And people look at sex differently. And the book says we're not going to draw any moral lines. We're not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Sex for an Eskimo is different than it is down here in Florida. And the way you look at sex in Florida is a hell of a lot different than the way they look at it in San Francisco, I'll guarantee. And the way they look at it in Frisco is different than the way it is in London. So my book's not going to do anything to condemn me about sex. It just suggests that I look at my sex life And then it suggests that I determine what's right and what's wrong with the help of a power greater than I am. You see, all my sex conduct before was determined by self-will, by Charlie's will, rather than by God's will. Now then, I've decided to let God be the director of my life. I'm going to start trying to figure out a way to have sex based on what His will would be rather than what my will would be.
Okay. Now, whom did I harm? What did I do? We go straight down. And then we're going to come over and we're going to find out, you know, where was self involved in this sex situation. I think that it's going to be quite enlightening for anybody and for most people that do an inventory, that, you know, before we do an inventory, we got one impression of our sex conduct. And I think that after we do an inventory, we'll see a whole different picture of the whole thing. Now, you would think that if it was a harm done by sex, that when you finish filling out those three columns, that it should appear that most of the sex problems should be caused by the sex instinct. But I think that you're going to really be surprised if you do this right. We're going to find out, actually, that in most cases, most of our sex problem, sex conduct was not caused by the sex instinct. Most of it is caused by our social instincts. See, it's our self-esteem. As we say, most of us fellas, we build our self-esteem with sex. And that's one of the greatest parts of self that causes sex problems. You know, sometimes we buy emotional security with sex. And we'll find out a lot of checks will be in that column. And some of us buy material security with sex. Once you do your inventory, in most cases, very few of the sex problems are actually caused by the sex drive. They were caused by the other parts, but we would have never known that if we have not really done the inventory in this fashion and analyzed it by using this sheet.
See, before this sheet, I assumed that everything I did wrong sexually was caused by that sexual drive. But I find after doing the sheet that very seldom was I really after the physical gratification and release that comes from sex. I found that I used sex for various different things. Now, I don't know about you girls, but we boys, as we grew up, we found out you could use this as a measure of being a man. Now, the more of this you could do, the more places you could do it in, the greater stud you really are. Now, we called it John Wayneism. I don't know what you girls call it. And some of you tell me that you seem to have been afflicted with the same problem, maybe not going quite as far as we did, you know. But the attraction to a member of the opposite sex is a thing that is used. We can use that to build our ego. We can get married in a situation and have perfectly good physical sex at home. But we begin to miss this ego-building thing that comes from attracting a member of the opposite race, and we become restless and irritable. And we do a little flirtation, and next thing you know, the little flirtation has gone a little further. And we aren't sure whether we ought to continue or not, because we know if we do, we might get in trouble. But the desire to build the ego is so strong, we step over the line and we go. And then we get to feel guilty about that. Well, sex didn't cause that at all. You know, building the self-esteem caused that. Sometimes we can use sex to develop and buy a personal relationship. We're so lonely and we're so alone and we want the companionship of another human being. And we feel that if we give sex, we can get that back. We men give sex to get love, and they tell me you women give love to get sex. I don't know which way it is. Could be the other way around. Don't have any idea. But I know that we can use sex to develop and build personal relationships. We could even use sex to get even. Maybe we got a relationship going on with another human being. And we find that human being has gone out and they've been doing things they shouldn't do in a sexual area and infuriates the hell out of us. And we say, by God, we'll get even with him. We'll show them. And then we go out and we do the same thing in order to get even with them. And then we get to carry that load and that guilt with us too. We can withhold sex to get even. We can say they're not doing what we want to do, so we'll show them. By God, we'll cut them off at the pass. Now, we men aren't too good at that, but you girls are damn good at it. We can only do that 2 or 3 days. You all seem to be able to do it for months. In some cases, years. My book does not seem to care how I do sex. If I want to do sex hanging upside down by my toenails from a tree, that's all right with my book. It doesn't care. My book says what I need to do is review each situation and put it to the critical test. Was it caused by selfishness or was it not? Mm-hmm. Was it caused by fear or was it not? Was there dishonesty involved in it or was there not? Was there inconsideration of other human beings involved in it or was there not? Does it hurt other people or does it not? And if it does any of those things, chances are it's going to give me a problem in the future. And again, it's not a question of whether I want to get rid of this or not. We got to face the fact, resentments and fears, and especially this sexual thing, sometimes is a hell of a lot of fun. And we get enjoyment out of it. But the question is, can I afford to live with it or not? Can I afford to pay that price? Can I afford to have my peace of mind stolen from me by doing these things? If I continue with shame and fear and guilt and remorse, sooner or later it seems as though the mind returns back to the idea of having a drink. Sanity returns and we drink. And with us, to drink is to die. So we're not talking about morality at all. We're not talking about what's right and what's wrong. What we're talking about is what robs us of peace of mind. And I know that if we keep putting ourselves into those situations, we keep robbing ourselves of peace of mind. And even if we don't put ourselves in them, if we keep wanting to put ourselves in them, and we keep being dissatisfied because we're not in them, we've robbed ourselves of peace of mind. So what the book is really saying is I need to change my attitude toward sex. And again, this is not a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. Well, the book doesn't care whether you have sex with a monkey or not. That's your business. What the book says is list the people that we have harmed by our sexual conduct in the past. And that's not a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. It's not hard to do. Nearly every one of us know it. Nearly all of us can fill this thing out.
Okay, in this way we try to shape a sane and sound idea of our future sex life. We subject relation to the test. Was it selfish or not? And he says, here we have a little prayer in sex. We ask God to mold our ideas and help us live up to them. Remember always that our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither be used lightly or selfishly, nor be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideas turn out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends for where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. Now remember, as we make out this list, it reminds us here in a way, he kind of gets ahead of ourselves. We're going to have some things in step 8 and 9. We're going to have some things that will help us be able to handle these in the right way when we get to step 8 and 9. What we're doing right now, the only thing we're doing is putting it on paper. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God to mold what we should do in each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. Now, we see prayer scattered throughout step 4. We usually hear about step 3 prayer, but there's prayer in every step after step 3. Throughout, we will find prayer. God alone can judge our sex situations. Counsel with other person is desirable. Final judge. We realize that some people are fanatical about sex and others are loose. We avoid hysteria, thinking our advice. And this is the only way, you don't know which one of these people we're talking to. And it says, we let God alone judge each of these situations. Suppose we fall short of the chosen idea. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but we think this is only half true. And here we're talking about a very strong drive, one of the strongest drives in man. And it's not something that we're going to correct right away. He said we can even make mistakes in trying to grow toward this thing. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we'll be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continue to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts of our experience. To sum up sex, we earnestly pray, and again we have prayer, for the right idea, for guidance in each questionable situation, for insanity and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves hard into others. We think of their needs and their works for them. This takes us out of ourselves and acquires the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. And this is a real, you know, it gives us the ultimate weapon here of combating a sex problem. And it also can be used for resentments or fear, too. But seems sometimes that one of the best ways that we alcoholics can get out of self is to work with another alcoholic. And once you go to work with another alcoholic, this takes you out of self. And then God can automatically come into your life and deal with your problem. So if it not only will it work on sex, it'll work on any other problem. Because while we get involved in another alcoholic's life, God can come into our lives. Okay. Now he makes a summation here. And if we have completed these three sheets, and I think that anybody really that wants to, you know, is really wanting to do his inventory, and we could sit down really in one night, in just a little while, and go through this, the right stage of mind, and complete his inventory. It's not that big a task as we have been making with a lot of other different things we've been using. And it's done the way we have some factual material to do a fifth step with. Now, he makes a summary here. If we have been through our personal inventory, through these three sheets, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. Not only that, and I love it, we have listed and analyzed them. We have been able to list them and then see where they came from and got it all down in great detail. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destruction for the first time. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, while we look on them as sick people. You know, as we said that we were going to go through these steps, we were going to have some personality changes sufficient to recover. And step three was the beginning, and Charlie said we got rid of resentments, and now we went through all this, and now he says here at the end of step four, we have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. You know, step four is not a negative step. Step four is a positive step. We get results out of step four. Because he says right here that we got tolerance and patience and goodwill toward all men. And any time an alcoholic starts to learn tolerance and patience and goodwill toward all men, that is a personality change in step four. Okay. We have listed people we had hurt and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. Now, that is a personality change when an alcoholic is willing to straighten out his past. That is the result of step four. In this book, we read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. Again, he's talking about that decision in step three. You made a decision, but now you can see that God can remove the things that block you off from him. If you have already made a decision,
step three,
and an inventory of your grosser handicap,
step four,
you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Now, he didn't say that we are perfect. He said we just got some of our grosser handicaps. The step four is to, you know, we take step four. It's the first attempt to get rid of our grosser handicaps. You know, most people around, you hear a lot of people around AA, everybody wants to wait until you can do step four perfectly. Step four is not designed to get you perfect. Step four is to get rid of the grosser handicap. It's a starting point. You know, I think too many people around feel the idea that they want to get well and then take the steps. Rather than take the steps to get well. You know what I mean? They won't wait till they get well and then I'm going to take them. But the steps, we just start where we are. Step four is to remove just our grosser handicaps, just a starting point. We're going to be working on this thing for the rest of our life.
You know, we procrastinate and procrastinate and procrastinate, trying to get make sure we do a perfect job of taking step four.
Yeah.
And we're going to see in step five where it's impossible for us to do a perfect job when we take step four. Yeah. All of our life, we've been conners, we've been manipulators, we've been rationalizers. We've had to be that if we're going to be practicing alcoholics. You can't be a practicing alcoholic and be 100% honest. You got to be able to lie and con and manipulate people, and especially yourself. And if we wait until we get well to take step four, I'm afraid we'll never take step four, because we'll never be able to do it perfect. The only thing we can possibly hope to do is look at the grosser handicaps which block us off from God's will. The most damaged and unsaleable items on our shelf. And my book says those are resentments and fears and harms that I've done to other people. And if I get those out of the way, then later on there will be another step that will show me how and let me refine the process and make it better and better and better. But right now I'm removing just enough of this stuff that I'll be able to get on with the rest of the program. And it refers to it as the grosser handicaps. Okay, page 72. Now then that I've taken the inventory, so far I've been dealing with just myself and God. And that hadn't seemed to be quite so bad. Because I figured all along that, you know, God kind of knew what I was doing. So it didn't seem to be too bad to deal with him on this, some of this stuff. And certainly I knew what I was doing most of the time. Once in a while I might not have in a blackout, but generally I knew what I was doing. And it wasn't quite that bad dealing with myself. But now then I'm getting ready to start reaching out to the rest of the human race. And we think there's a specific reason for this. You know, all human beings are tri-dimensional creatures. We've heard this all of our life and we've known this all of our life. And tri-dimensional creatures are made up basically of three things. They're made up of the spirit, they're made up of the mind, and they're made up of their physical relationship with their own selves and the rest of the world in general. And we know that all human beings are tri-dimensional. We live with the spirit deep within inside of us. Our book told us that in the beginning, way back on page 47, somewhere along in there. Talked about the fact that deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, and it's only there that he may be found. We all have a mind. We live within our mind also. And we all have a physical body and a relationship with the world and the people around us. And we must live in all three of these dimensions, whether we want to or not. We really don't have a hell of a lot of choice about it. And the only question is can we live in all three dimensions in harmony? And prior to coming to AA, the answer was no. Certainly we did not live in harmony with the Spirit. Certainly we did not live in harmony with the world and the people around us. Certainly because of our alcoholism, we eventually withdrew into ourselves. As Bill said, he became a loner. And we tried to live within our mind only. And we just got sicker and sicker and sicker. So what we're really doing, we're following a process to redevelop the proper relationship in these three dimensions. And we've already done that through 1, 2, and 3. We've developed the proper relationship when we decided to let God be the director of our life. We're going to quit running on self-will. We're going to run on God's will. We're already beginning to do that in the second relationship of the mind. We're beginning to see what separates us from God's will and what we'll have to get rid of. And then later on, we'll have a couple of steps that will straighten us out in our relationship with the world and the people in general. And step 5 follows this same pattern, where we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. And here's where we begin to reach out into all three dimensions of our life. And there must be a reason behind this. And I think it is to start the process of developing these proper relationships with other people. Let's see what Bill had to say about it. On page 72, he says, "Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it?" We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when it's completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the 5th step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. And before we go any further, let's look at something.